This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
Leaders from around the world were in Beijing last week to attend China's Belt and Road Initiative Forum. The flagship project started as a plan for the Asian nation to help fund infrastructure projects and trading routes around the globe, but seems to have expanded to include technology and governance. The U.S. and India didn't send official representatives to this summit, while those who attended included leaders from Austria, Portugal, Italy, the Philippines, even Russian President Vladimir Putin. This highlights the growing influence that China is having around the globe and perhaps the waning interest that the U.S. is garnering. With more, we're joined here in studio by Minwan Zhao, who's an associate professor of management here at the Wharton School, and also by Marshall Meyer, professor emeritus of management here at the Wharton School. Good to see you both.
Good morning.
Great to have you both with us. I guess this concern that the U.S. is apparently showing, why do you think there is such a focus on that right now, Marshall?
Well, if you look at the surface, it appears that China's extending its influence economically and even militarily, as in Djibouti, way, way beyond their national borders and, you know, beyond the traditional peripheral, can we use the old word, tributary states?
Yep.
And it should be of concern for many reasons, one of which is the U.S. withdrawal from TPP, which is now history. It was to be a partial counter to Belt and Road, but it continues without the U.S. But what are our European allies to do, given the stance of the U.S.? I don't know the answer to that.
Meanwhile?
Well, let me just put down my premise here. And since you know me, you know I'm not happy with a lot of things going on in China.
Yeah.
And you know I'm not super enthusiastic about the Road and Belt Initiative. That said, I really believe the Western media and the governments are overshooting the importance of those projects and usually biased only in one direction. So, you know, I think my premise is important, but I, given that there's a lot of overshooting going on, yes, it's a threat of Chinese influence. But on the other hand, they're talking about all those horrible projects that will never get China will never get a return back. Well, if that's the case, why are you so worried if they're destined to fail? So it was like one negative news conflicting with another negative news. The problem with this is negative news are self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, the warning about the Chinese influence, the warning about failures, the repeated mention of Sri Lanka port, that seems to be the only story that every media article has to mention, despite the fact that this is like one of maybe 1,000 projects going on right now. It's self-fulfilling in the sense that pessimism lead to lack of participation and lack of commitment, lack of long-term cooperation, and that itself is going to lead to failure. So, yeah, this is an unfortunate dynamic going on right now.
So are there elements, and you mentioned that you said you're not happy overall with the belief of where Belt and Road may be going, but are there elements of it that you see that are beneficial when you're talking about the building out of relationships between China and other countries?
Well, there are. So can I give an example?
Sure, please.
So this morning I was driving in and NPR was talking about the power plants China was trying to build. And this is a typical coverage you hear or see. They're going to build a power plant, which means pollution. Right. Well, what would be the alternative? The alternative is one, there's no electricity in the area. Right. Second, just like when I was growing up, when electricity is lacking, you burn whatever you can burn to get fuel, which can be very polluting. Now, I would like to know what kind of technology China is going to use in those power plants. How, you know, power plants does not automatically translate to pollution if they can employ the best technology. So what kind of power plants is being built? What kind of fuels will these power plants replace? Is that highly polluting wood burning thing that the locals use to get electricity, or any other alternatives. So I think the devil is really in the details.
Sure,
this kind of broad brush just to paint an ugly picture of 150 power plants will not help anyone.
Marcia?
Depends on which newspaper you read.
Okay.
Okay.
Pick up the Jerusalem Post.
Okay.
Okay, for example, and read about the Port of Haifa. Now, I'm not sure where that stands today, but the intent was for China to assume management of the Port of Haifa this month. It's very contentious both ways, because on the one hand, there are commercial advantages for Israel, but it also means that the U.S. Mediterranean fleet cannot call on the Port of Haifa. Now, add to this the proposed railway from Eilat in the Red Sea up to Haifa, kind of an alternative to the Suez Canal. Very attractive to Israel because it puts them in a pivotal point in the Middle East that they've always occupied anyway, but it just makes them more pivotal. And yet subjects them to a little more Chinese influence. So you, depending on which newspaper you pick up in Israel, you'll get a different opinion as to which way Israel ought to go. If you talk to the young entrepreneurs, they'll say, let's go with this because our future lies in trade with China. The more senior people who remember the votes China has made essentially against Israel's interest in the UN have a very different view, of course.
How expansive then do you both think the influence from Belt and Road is right now? And I've seen a variety of different estimations of how many countries are involved or at least interested, how much money we're talking about that is actually starting to move to be able to build out some of these projects. And I think with a lot of things in government these days, I think people will sit back and say, well, is it really 150 countries, $90 billion, or is it quite a different number?
I think the estimate, again, depending on who you talk with and which newspaper you read, will vary widely from one end to the other. Two complications, right? One is, will China lump any projects that would have been going on anyway into the Road and Belt? And this is what I observe, at least in China, the infrastructure projects that would have happened anyway, leading from Shanghai all the way to the southwest part of China, and now part of the Road and Belt Initiative, because by labeling it as Road and Belt, it's easier to get funding, it's easier to get government support along the way. So to what extent it's just a big bracket of things that would have happened anyway, right?
Right.
And the second part is, to what extent it's committed investment, to what extent is investments that are actually going on. So depending on the time horizon you're looking at, the estimates is everywhere. The thing is, I think the biggest impact will happen in the most difficult areas, difficult places that...
Go ahead. Okay. No, I'm sorry. Because I think that's a concern in some cases of some of the smaller countries that may not have the financing to be able to do some of these projects, maybe getting in a little too far financially over their head.
That's my second half. Thing is, right now, when you look at impact, of course, China can really make an impact in areas where usual investors will be reluctant to go.
Yeah.
But that also means these are the most risky and, the places where you will never see return or sustainability. And if there's no sustainability, there's no impact to begin with.
Marshall?
Darn right. The language that came out of the Belt and Road meeting, I picked up one word repeatedly. Rehabilitation of Belt and Road Initiative. Now, what's got to be rehabilitated here? Not the concept. I think the concept's what's got people. Mm-hmm. The idea that China's going to recreate the Silk Road, maybe with traffic flowing in the opposite direction. But what's got to be rehabilitated is the underlying financials. This is not foreign aid, as the U.S. practiced it. This is not the Marshall Plan.
Right.
It is rather, as you said, Minyan, Chinese investment that expects a return. And the initial investment's usually loan. But here's what's interesting. Who does the infrastructure construction? Typically Chinese mm-hmm. companies. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese government is loaning money to a country. The country carries the obligation, like Pakistan. We can talk about that rather than Sri Lanka if you want. Mm-hmm. And a Chinese company, however, receives much of the proceeds of the loan. So those proceeds stay at home, mm-hmm. basically. But the host country has got the debt. Now, here's a question you raised, basically. What's the ROI on the project? Is the ROI sufficient to pay off the debt?
Correct,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah, that's the big deal.
Sure.
Okay, if it isn't, what happens? China comes in. It's happened in Pakistan as well as Sri Lanka. They basically repossess.
Right.
So it becomes a debt for equity swap.
Right.
Yeah.
But guess what? The debt's still there.
Yeah. The debt is still there, and the equity probably does not worth much.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
I think the counter-argument, and I think the theoretical, you know, ideal of the situation is by itself, every single object, every single project will not produce enough return on mm-hmm. investment. Mm-hmm. That's why the private investors are not going there, and that's why the usual investors are not going there.
Right.
China was hoping that by coordinating all these projects, by connecting all the railways, by connecting the waterway with the railways, by investing in such a big, ambitious project, every single project will generate more return.
Correct.
In
right.
aggregate.
Right.
right? So this is the whole idea of state sponsor. Of course, you know, China said this
sure.
is private. But let's face it, you know, with the state sponsorship, this is what economists call externality. Right?
right.
You create enough externality to make every single investment, which would otherwise be uninvestable. I know it's not an English word, becomes a good project, you know, for the society, at least if you include externality uh-huh. into consideration. So that's the ideal. The problem is these are the most challenging geographic areas and institutional environments, you know, whether there's enough momentum going on to really create the coordinated effort. And that's why what I said, you know, at the beginning, all the negative news from the media, they're self-fulfilling prophecy.
So what then is, if from people that you both know mm-hmm. in China, what is the reaction right now in China by people, by maybe some of the politicians within that country, to this overall mindset of Belt and Road and where it could potentially go and the potential negative economic impact? And I hate to be one of the media focusing on the negative here,
right.
but the potential of the negative economic impact that we've laid out here.
And I think, you know, most of those conversations happen at dinner tables. Nobody likes to be
sure,
quoted or
sure.
say in public.
Right.
But I think the reality is sinking in. What happened in Venezuela was a big wake-up call. You know, all the Chinese investment in Venezuela. You know, keep in mind, again, these are difficult areas, mostly for institutional reasons. And if you don't have a stable institution, you know, behind all these investments, no return can be expected, not only on return, but even the principles can be dashed. So the several recent events are enough to be the wake-up call for policymakers to be more cautious of the risks and mm-hmm. to think more carefully. And there are even like official lines saying we need to be more conservative
right.
in going forward. But this is... The idea is still there, and again, the hope is to have more coordinated efforts.
Is it also a little bit of a hedge because of the Chinese economy and some of the things that are going on there in general right now?
Well, this goes in two opposite directions, right? On the one hand, because of the slowing economy, you don't have that much money to invest
True.
Or
yeah.
based overseas.
Right.
And the second is because of the slowing economy, you need the diversion of attention. You need the place to, you know, use up all your excessive capacity at home. You know, as Marshall said, most of the construction crews were from China. Most
yeah.
of the materials are from China. So this is one way to digest the excessive capacity.
Marshall?
I hope they're not hauling concrete from China.
They do.
But look, I see two totally different reactions. One of the reactions is, let's brand China Belt and Road. So one of my friends, for example, is running around the world a Belt and Road fashion show. I understand where the belts come in, but
right.
I'm not sure about the roads.
Right, exactly.
But seriously, this is China's global brand.
Sure.
On the one hand. On the other hand, I think part of the rehabilitation is in the context of the trade war with the U.S. This is hitting China. And the capacity of China to loan funds outward, to stretch their financial capacity even further than it's already stretched, and mm-hmm. it's really stretched, at a time when their export machine is up against a bunch of challenges, I think is going to give them a little bit of pause mm-hmm. on these projects. And I think that, for host countries, for client countries of Belt and Road, that there lies the opportunity. You know, let's mention Malaysia, for example. Mm-hmm. They got a 33% discount on their railroad, right?
Yeah.
They're back in business mm-hmm. with them. My understanding as of this morning is that the European countries, unlike Italy, are not going to go singly to China. They're going to go as a group, probably led by Germany. And again, try to negotiate volume discounts.
Sure, yeah.
And at the end of the day, there's the possibility, by no means the certainty, that the winners of this will be the host countries and not China. Let's see the terms of trade, then we'll know.
Mirwan?
Yeah, I think this is really a dynamic, almost game theory kind of question, right? Depending on, it's a multi-party game theory type of scenario in which everyone is making the move, expecting what others will do.
Sure, yeah.
So the end result is very difficult to predict. I think it can be a doubling down effort from China, you know, given that China does not have to disclose its government budget budget book to anyone. It can be a doubling down effort to stem the slowdown of domestic economy and just to show to a certain extent this is a success. This is also a face thing which China really values.
Well, it also makes me wonder, if there would be a slowing down of this initiative,
mm-hmm.
especially considering it is the signature of mm-hmm. President Xi,
right.
and President Xi is, quote unquote, president for life. And how that aspect of his leadership and to a degree control of what China is expected to do will
right.
play into where Belt and Road goes.
Right. So he has his signature on it. And as I said, it has to show some degree of success. But realistically, any slowdown means failure.
Okay.
Right. To make it a success, it has to generate enough coordinated effort, enough externality for all the countries involved. And slowdown means this vision has not been accomplished. And because so far it's still very, very far from this vision.
Right.
And that's failure because taken individually, none of those projects should have happened.
Marshall?
I agree fully with Mirwan. I want to add something. Belt and Road brilliantly masks China's external dependencies.
Mm-hmm.
For the foreseeable future, China will remain dependent for energy from abroad.
Yeah.
They can develop solar. They can develop wind. Most are located in the West. They do have ultra-high voltage transmission going. But still, they're going to have to import oil and especially now liquefied natural gas because it's cleaner than oil.
Yeah.
They don't have the shale resources they have. They can't recover. They've got a food problem. They've always had a bit of a problem of feeding their folks. But right now, you've got this plague called African swine flu that's likely to wipe out half the pigs in China. And this means they're going to be dependent not just on imported soybeans to feed their pigs, but actually imported pork. And they own, for example, Smithfield in the United States. They can lean on them a little bit.
Yeah.
But still, it's going to put a strain on world markets. It's going to put a strain on their domestic economy. So these pressures and tensions give a slightly different coloration to Belt and Road, because it's not so much China going external to make investments. It's China going out to supply its domestic needs.
Right. And then I guess to a degree, there's a sense of the country maybe even treading water a little bit because of these issues that they have within their borders as well. As you just laid out with the issue with pork and the swine flu, that you have to – you're dealing with an element greater than you probably would like to at this point, and the economic impact that obviously it will have on a large country like China.
Yeah, to be sure. And it will further slow the growth of the Chinese economy. And the impact on employment remains to be seen, but there could be an impact there.
Myanmar?
Yeah, but this is the kind of time where you would be happy to have a president in life, right? So,
sure.
You know, at least there's no panic yet, expecting the regime stability. So, yes, there will be slowdown, there will be impact, but, you know, there are also more coordinated efforts to stimulate the economy, and there are shining parts of the economy that is still growing fast. You know, consumer is growing fast. The recent box office release has China in a, I think last weekend, there's a bigger box office number from China than in the U.S.
For Avengers?
Yeah.
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 Okay. Yeah. So, you know, there are still areas that are growing. And I don't think, at least from the domestic point of view, there's no panic yet.
Right.
From the external point of view, I agree. Those areas, when you face the trade war with the U.S., there are other parts of press release of pressure for China. So, yeah, I don't know. It's such a dynamic process. Any single change from any players in the community, Italy, for example, significantly changed the prospect of this project going forward. Turkey can be an easy, veto power in the whole road process that is going on all the way to Europe. There are so many critical points and so many bottlenecks that can make or break the deal. It's really hard.
So is this the most important area to focus on in the next several months of what these European countries try to do, as Marshall mentioned, trying to get a kind of a group deal, get a discount,
right.
You know, in the process. It's what these countries as a group will try and do that will really, to a degree, determine the success or failure of Belt and Road.
I think it's very important. What's the point of building thousands of miles of railway in all the way into the East Asia West Asia and East Europe if you cannot connect it to the major markets?
Yeah.
So the value of the Road and Belt is in its ability to connect economies, and the major economies are over there.
Marshall?
Yet I'm surprised by one thing. This is a 20th century project, not a 21st century project.
Okay.
It's physical infrastructure,
yep.
Largely.
Yep.
But what has China done best? Oh, granted, they have built their physical infrastructure, but what they've really done best, in my judgment, is development of electronic commerce. Mm-hmm. And you read through the World Bank Development Report, and it's got a whole chapter in there on the impact of electronic commerce on developing economies.
Right.
So a question is, why isn't China exporting this capability where they've done so well?
Well, Huawei... Well, in order to do that, you need internet. You need all the infrastructure to connect people. And guess what? You know, once the railroad is there, you can ship all the equipment. And I guess the next thing is you will see the Huawei towers over there.
So your argument is this is Act One. Wait for Act Two.
This is Act One. Yeah.
I see. Okay.
Great seeing you both.
Okay.
Looking forward. I know we'll be talking about this again. Great to see you both. Thanks for
My
coming
pleasure.
In.
Thanks so much, Don.
You got it. Minwon Zhao, Marshall Meyer from here at the Wharton School.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.